By now, you've likely heard about Lovecraft Country, the dark horror fantasy series airing on HBO, but how much do you know about the source material? Well, we have the source on this episode of Pop Life.
Digital content on W8YR is supported by Hunter Springs Landscape Artisans, helping clients throughout the Central New York community create their own unique outdoor living space for 37 years. Services and project galleries found at hunterspringslandscape.com.
Welcome to Pop Life. I'm Joe Lee. A few weeks ago, HBO began airing Lovecraft Country, a series that mashes science fiction with horror, fantasy, and drama to early critical acclaim. The series, adapted for the small screen by Misha Green and produced by Jordan Peele and J.J. Abrams, is based on the 2016 novel of the same name written by author Matt Ruff. He joins us today on Pop Life to talk about the book and his early perceptions of the HBO series. Today's show is produced by Kevin Kloss and Imani Lee. Here's our conversation with Matt Ruff.
Matt, it's a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure being here. Thank you for inviting me.
The first thing I wanted to discuss with you was give us for those that are not familiar either with your book or yet with the HBO series, or maybe they are starting to watch the series but aren't quite sure what the story is about. Give us a little bit about the theme and the story idea.
So the story is set in the 1950s in Chicago. It revolves around a black family who own a travel agency and publish a fictional version of the Green Book called The Safe Negro Travel Guide. And basically, the story has them getting drawn into a series of real-life weird tales that turn out to all be interconnected. And at the same time, they are dealing with sort of the real-life horrors of Jim Crow era, specifically, though, in the North, which is something that a lot of viewers of the viewers of the show have sometimes missed, because we were so used to associating segregation and Jim Crow racism with the South. But in fact, it was just as pernicious in the North and West, and in some ways was worse, because at least in the South, you had extensive signage showing you where you were and weren't welcome. Whereas it was when you were traveling in the North and other parts of the country that you really needed a guidebook to tell you where you could safely go. And the title is really sort of a metaphorical reference both to the sort of the paranormal landscape where monsters come from, but also white America, where a different kind of monster comes from. Because, of course, H.P. Lovecraft was famously both, he's an incredibly influential and important horror writer, but he was also an avid white supremacist. And so that's sort of the basic idea. And yes, the main character, Atticus Turner, and his Uncle George are both nerds. So they're also both big fans of horror and pulp fiction, which is another thing that, for black nerds, especially in the 50s, it just, the genre didn't love them back. Mm-hmm. And it's about the trials and tribulations of that as well, which is another point of Lovecraft that, you know, you can really get into his fiction, but boy, if you're not a white person, he will constantly be reminding you that, yeah, I don't think of you as a real person either. So, right. Yeah.
So why did you settle on the backdrop of Jim Crow for this story? And how did you settle on telling this story through the development of black characters?
So, I mean, the initial idea, really, it started out in 2007. I had been invited to pitch ideas for original TV series. And one of the things I'd always been curious about doing was like an X-Files type show where you would have this recurring cast of characters having, you know, weekly paranormal adventures. And I wanted to do something with a different group of characters and a different set of cultural concerns than you would typically see, because those shows typically, particularly in those days, would focus on white protagonists, mainly more diverse, maybe a little more diversified as time went on, but like the X-Files, it was two white FBI agents. Kolchak, the Night Stalker, which is probably the version of this, mm-hmm. was a white reporter. So I just, you know, and I had black friends in the past talking about the difficulties that they had, you know, sort of feeling comfortable in largely white spaces. And I was aware of the history of this. And I had read a book by James Lowen called Sundown Towns. It's this fascinating history about the history of whites only communities in America. That's where I first heard about the Green Book. That's where I first heard about the Tulsa Massacre. that's where I first basically got a really deep education in, you know, the sort of forgotten history of racism in the North and West, and how it happens that there are these large areas of the country that are even today basically whites only. There was this sort of lost history of ethnic cleansing that went on starting around the 1890s and continuing through the mid 20th century. So it struck me that this would be an interesting idea to use that, this kind of story as a framework for talking about that. And at the same time, telling interesting adventure stories, taking these classic genre tropes that typically would not feature a Black protagonist and seeing how they changed when you put a Black character in there. And just seemed like there was a lot you could do there, a lot of rich storytelling you could get out of that. So that was the inspiration. And maybe unusual in that I've always liked telling stories about folks who are different from me. I mean, part of the joy of fiction for me is that it lets me explore worldviews and beliefs and lives that are not like mine. And that just seems like a natural use of fiction for me. But particularly this issue of a white author writing from a Black perspective, I understand that it's a very fraught concept for a lot of folks, but to me, it's just, I was aware that I might be playing to a tough crowd in a certain sense, but I also believe that as long as I, you know, took my time and didn't get lazy and told a good story, I would be able to move past that skepticism and, you know, tell a good tale. So.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, being a Black man and reading the book, that I found the voices very authentic. So I'm very curious as to what kind of preparation you did, what kind of exploration you did, to sort of avoid some of the pitfalls that some earlier white writers may have made when trying to develop Black POVs or Black voices. How did you prepare to create these characters and have them be authentic?
Well, I mean, part of it is just not seeing it as, not underestimating the challenge, but not overestimating it either. I just didn't assume that I couldn't do it. And the main thing is that I approach characters, regardless of who I'm writing about or what their background is, I approach them as individuals rather than as members of a, you know, I think that's the first trap that people fall into, is that they talk about, you know, Black folks as if they're a generic type rather than as individuals who are as diverse as any other, you know, kind of person. And so a lot of it for me is just, I start the same way I would with any book, of deciding, okay, what are the roles that each of these characters are going to play in the story? And then let me think about their relationships to each other, their personal histories. And, you know, much of the research is not so much the characters themselves, but the world that they live in. I mean, the big focus for me in this novel was specifically the challenge of navigating your way through a country that doesn't really have a place for you. I mean, that was the thing that initially piqued my interest, was just learning about the Green Book. And then from there, sort of realizing that was just the tip of the iceberg of this vast infrastructure that Black Americans had to create for themselves. I mean, you know, the goal was always equality, but until you get there, until the, you know, the arc of history bends towards justice, you've still got to get through the day. And so there were all of these resources and tips and tricks that you had to develop in order to just survive. That was really what I was more focused on, is digging up that lost history and like, okay, so, you know, if I'm going to write a story about a woman buying a house in a Black woman buying a house in a white neighborhood in Chicago, well, what exactly would be involved in that? And it was, you know, like, what are the rules? You can't get a mortgage. So she's going to have to do this installment contract, which is it's like renting to own, which is a terrible, terrible deal. But just basically learning what the characters were up against, what the rules of the world were that they were living in. And then from there, just, you know, these are rational human beings. They're resourceful. How would they deal with that? And what instincts and adaptations would they, you know, their characters necessarily have in order to deal with that world? And again, it's just the trap is just not to think that this is, you're dealing with some other species. These are still basically folks. And I mean, we're talking about English-speaking Americans from the Midwest, so there's plenty of common ground there. It's just that, you know, my people didn't have the same hurdles living in that part of the country at that time. So,
so yeah, and so, you know, you and I are about the same age. early happy birthday to you. I think that's coming up in a couple of weeks, right?
Yeah.
And so neither one of us were around during the sort of the heart of Jim Crow. So how did you go about building that world in a way that you could understand it and make it authentic? Because it feels, you know, when I'm reading your book and obviously watching the show, the horrors of that era come alive, you know, and it feels really authentic. What kind of research did you do? I mean, you there are some subtleties in there that really, you know, give the characters some credibility and a sort of a nod and a wink at folks like me. So when I see that they are members of the Prince Hall Freemasons, you know, I have family members who are Prince Hall Freemasons. So finding little things like that to build these characters. I'm just interested in what kind of research you did to help do that.
I mean, the historical record is there if you go looking for it. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, Sundown Towns was my first big historical research thing, and that gave me a lot of leads. I read about a year's worth of back issues of the Chicago Defender just to see what kinds of cultural issues and things people were talking about at the time. And then I'm blanking on the name, but there is someone published an actual a book of like the basically it's a guidebook to the Jim Crow or the racist laws in every state. So like who may marry who where, and you know what are the restrictions on jobs in every state, organized by state. So it's like a satirical but accurate guidebook to life in the United States at that time. And that was fascinating to like see, okay, so your marriage is valid in this state, but you can't have an interracial marriage in this state. You know, this is what you have to go through to get a house in this area. And if, so things like that. And I've got a good eye for useful anecdotes where I'll just see something and I'm like, okay, I know what I can do with that. Let me remember that and bring it up later. And it's, it's just lots of reading about, you know, and then memoirs. And, you know, there was a memoir I read about, again, about a gentleman who had bought a house in, I believe, I forget the name of the neighborhood, but it was east of Cottage Grove, which was an area that was white for a very long time. And he was one of the first people to buy a house there. And talking about his experience, they moved in on a Sunday because if you had to do it when the white folks were at church, because if you didn't, they would try to physically prevent the moving van from, and the fact that you had to hire a white person to actually do the purchase of the house for you and trust them not to screw you on the deal. Because if you even came to the neighborhood, people would notice and they'd be like, wait a minute, no, that's not right. So like the thing that stuck out to me, that this guy bought a house and didn't see the inside of it until the day he moved in, because he couldn't go there to look. So he sort of, that just, the day after they moved in, every other house in the block has a sign up saying, you know, undesirables at such and such address must go. And then the next year, they were basically, until other black families started moving into that area, they basically were just, they had to be alert night and day to vandalism, to, you know, so things so like that. And you just, it's not really that hard to imagine what that would do to you if you were stuck in that situation. So,
And then you take that situation and you throw on top of it, you need a sorcerer from a secret society to bankroll the purchase for you.
You mentioned the Prince Hall Freemasons. Obviously, that was another thing too, was that, yes, the professional organizations and fraternal orders, a lot of them were whites only. So black folks created parallels to that. And that was very useful because I had the Prince Hall Freemasons to sort of set up against this cabal of white sorcerers. And that was just a cool bit to have anyway. So just a lot of stuff like that where I would did the research and stuff would stick with me. And then I just sort of knitted it all together. So
why H.P. Lovecraft? What, I mean, you spoke a little bit about it when we first started, but why H.P. Lovecraft as the, so how did the idea come? Was it that you started with, I want to create a story about sort of black geeks, sci-fi loving people,
right?
Or was it the H.P. Lovecraft piece first?
No, it definitely started out, as I say, as a sort of a black nerd 1950s X-Files. But then I needed a name and I needed a thematic bridge between paranormal horror and racism. And Lovecraft is perfect for that because he's both. And I mean, there are other authors you could have used, because as I discovered when I was trying to talk about the general difficulty of, you know, of you, just about anything you read back then, you would encounter at least casual racism. And I kept finding it in places I wasn't even expecting to see it. Like, you know, there's a Jekyll and Hyde story. And so I was rereading Robert Louis Stevenson for the first time in a long time. And I'm like, oh, isn't that interesting that, yes, Hyde is described as swarthy. He's not black, but the description that Stevenson gives to him makes it clear he is at least Eastern European and possibly Jewish. It's mm-hmm. just, it always goes back to that. And this was and then, you know, John Carter of Mars, where the guy was, of course, before he becomes a Martian warlord, he's a Southern
right.
soldier, a Confederate soldier who fought for slavery, and his slaves loved him, of course. And so it was just, I could have used any number of these people, but Lovecraft really has this central place in horror where he's just regarded as, he's very important. He's sort of deep into the DNA of the genre, and yet he really was out there in terms of being very, very outspoken white supremacist. And mm-hmm. so, and this is something that the genre has been grappling with for a long time. And there's a lot of folks don't want to deal with it. They're like, well, yes, but we like his story, so let's not bring it up. And then there's black horror fans who are saying, well, yeah, we kind of got to talk about this. So mm-hmm. So it was topical in that sense, but it just seemed a good choice. But my intention was always to have a much broader palette in terms of bringing in, it was not just horror, but science fiction and fantasy mm-hmm. and action adventure and you know, all sorts of genre tropes, and then combine that with this much more realistic historical social commentary. And that just seemed like a cool thing to do. But Lovecraft just made a good thematic overarching presence. And right. of course, once I named the book that, I obviously started bringing in a few more exclusively Lovecraftian elements, like the book of names in the novel, which is rather like his Necronomicon, and a couple of other things as well. But mm-hmm. again, it was always a broader palette, and it was more the black nerd adventure was there first, and Lovecraft right. came in the back door.
I like how you hammer home to the conflict that Tick has with loving science fiction and writers like that who didn't love him back by having his father make him memorize one of Lovecraft's more racist poems. I mean, that really does, you know, bring to light that that conflict in him that says, I really love this genre, but yeah, there's some horrible things about that that don't represent me.
Well, I mean, that's a point of connection. I mean, I think a lot of white nerds, I never had a problem. My parents were fine with me reading whatever I wanted, but I know there are plenty of white nerds who grew up with their parents saying, oh, why are you reading that trash? And mm-hmm. they can empathize with that. But then if you're black in that situation, your parents have got more ammo because they can say, yeah, not only is this trash, but look at what you're dealing with. And one of the inspirations for me, there's a woman named Pam Knowles, who's a black science fiction fan, and she wrote an essay called Shame that was posted online right around the time I was starting to think about this. And it talks about her own struggles with this, where when she was young, you know, there's an age where you just don't see the stuff. And then her father would watch science fiction with her on TV in their basement, and he would be pointing things out and saying, oh, what's this one called, Planet of the White People? Do you notice there are no black characters in this? And she would be like, Dad, just leave me alone and let me enjoy this. And the moment for her when she sort of got what her father was telling her, it's heartbreaking. She talks about going to see Star Wars, which was, you know, for her, as for the other people my age, you know, was a quasi-religious nerd experience. But at the same time, yeah.
That was me.
But at the same time, it was like the moment when she finally realized what her father was trying to tell her, because she's watching this spectacle on screen and realizing, oh, they're all white people, except for that, like that, there was that one pilot you see for 2 seconds before he gets blown up. And right. so she goes home like in tears, and her parents are like, well, yeah, what are you upset about? We've been trying to tell you this. So that was something I really wanted to try to capture. And I got it that there is this thing when you're young, you really love things on there, you know, you love what you love, and you don't want to be told, you don't want to be, you don't have people coming in and tell you how to feel about stuff,
right.
but eventually that catches up to you and, or doesn't. I mean, there are still plenty of people in their, you know, 40s and 50s are still like, look, I don't want to hear about it. I love this. This is, you know, so mm-hmm.
So tell us about Tick. Let's get into some of the characters.
Sure.
Tell us about Tick. Who is Atticus?
So Atticus was sort of like my everyman character. He's the son of the family. He's 22 years old in the novel. I think he's somewhat older in the TV series, but he has this stormy relationship with his father, Montrose, who, you know, they're at odds with each other, because Montrose is the kind of dad, his own father was murdered during the Tulsa massacre, basically. And so he's basically one of those fathers that, like, his job is not to be his son's friend. His job is to keep his son alive and, you know, train him to take care of himself and not get himself killed when he's not around. And actually being liked by Atticus is like number 999 in the list of priorities. And of course, Atticus doesn't appreciate that, and he gets mm-hmm. along much better with his uncle George, who is this, you know, more easygoing, who's, you know, he's in the novel, he is Montrose's half-brother, mm-hmm. and his father died young too, but was not murdered, so he just comes from he's just got a much more mellow personality. I mean, he's still obviously affected by this, but he and Atticus have a much friendlier relationship and a shared love of genre fiction. So
Does Atticus get that from George, or did that develop independently?
No, he gets it from, I mean, it's a natural thing for him, but it's something he shares with his uncle. Mm-hmm. And in the book, Montrose is dyslexic, so he's just not a reader because he can't be comfortable doing that. Mm-hmm. He's very mechanically inclined, but that's a different thing. So anyway, Atticus joins the military and goes off to fight in Korea, which is another thing his father is serious about. It's like, why are you risking your life for this country that doesn't care about you? Mm-hmm. And he's come back. And then at the, you know, the beginning of the story, he's down in Florida working, and he gets this mysterious letter from his dad saying his dad's found something out about his mother's heritage. And this causes him to come running home. And by the time he gets there, his father has disappeared. And mm-hmm. the thing that's freaked him out is in the letter, his father's wants to go to a place called Arkham, Massachusetts, which Atticus, being a nerd, knows is not a real place. It's right. a fictional. So that's the start of the adventure. And then Atticus's childhood friend is Letitia Dandridge in the novel, mm-hmm. Letitia Lewis in the TV series. And
yeah, I was a little confused by that when I started watching the show. I was like, wait a minute, I thought her name was Dandridge.
Well, yeah, this is funny, because when I first visited the set, I was talking to one of the producers, and she was like, yeah, I started reading your novel and I had to stop because it's just different enough that it was confusing me completely. So, but he's got, yeah, his childhood friend is Letitia, and she's got an older sister, Ruby. And Letitia is sort of, you know, she's been out having adventures in the world as well. She's more of an operator, where her sister is sort of her older sister is sort of the hardworking, knows the grindstone gal who thinks her sister is completely flighty. And so they've got their issues. And then Uncle George is married to Hippolyta, who in her youth, basically she wanted to be Clyde Tombaugh, who's the guy who found Pluto. Right. And she's, you know, she loves astronomy, but she's a 6 foot tall black woman. And so there's just no role for her in the astronomy mm-hmm. field of that day. And so she's sort of been pining for a way into this. And her story revolves around finding out about this possibly abandoned observatory out in the middle of the Wisconsin woods. And so she drives out in the middle of the night to go look at it. And it turns out it can do more than just look at the stars. And so there's a whole adventure involved with that. And then
why did you name her Hippolyta?
I don't remember exactly, but just the idea of an Amazon name, because she's this big mm-hmm. gal, and I don't know. It just I don't actually recall, but it just seemed like a cool name to have.
It was it's pretty unique, yeah.
It led to this ongoing debate, of course, about how do you pronounce it. And I always called it Hippolyta, but I know Hippolyta is the way a lot of people mm-hmm. would pronounce it. And then Hippolyta and George have a son, Horace, in the novel. In the mm-hmm. in the TV series, that's been changed to a daughter, Diana. Right. And he's sort of the closest thing to a character, a Matt Ruff identity character in the novel, because he's this young budding artist. He wants to be a comic book artist when he grows up, and which is kind of appropriate then that the TV series, which is, you know, Misha Green is the central creative force in that, she's the showrunner, so mm-hmm. to change Horace to Diana kind of fit for me. And I think also Misha really wanted to get into the specific challenges that young black women faced growing up at that time, because that's something I think she felt had not been documented as much as the challenges young men face. So
you were okay with that change?
Oh yeah, I my version of the book, you know, my version of the story is told. It's locked. It's, you know, it's right there on the shelf behind me. Mm-hmm. So I was perfectly happy. I told Misha, like, this is, you know, this is what I did. This is why I did it. Here are my notes. Here's my research. And, you know, take what's useful, leave the rest. And, you know, I want to see what you do with it. And then I just sort of sat back and let her run with it. And I've been very happy with what she's done. So
what's the story with the Braithwaites and the Winthrops?
So, okay. The Braithwaites are a clan of white sorcerers. Although they refer to themselves as natural philosophers, because even though they do magic, they think of it as a form of science, because magic is for simple people. And basically the scion of the clan is Titus Braithwaite, who was basically a slave trader who lived in Boston in the 1700s, in late 1700s, and he built this lodge in North Central Mass called the Artem Lodge, where he would meet with his you know, other natural philosopher buddies, and they you know, basically they engaged in this ritual that of course went horribly wrong and killed them all and burned down the lodge. And the only survivor of this disaster in 1795 was a slave. And there was slavery in Massachusetts at this time. This one slave woman, Hannah, who was pregnant by Titus Braithwaite, she escapes the conflagration and gets out. And that is Atticus's great, 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 great grandmother. And so the present day Braithwaites are sort of distant cousins of Titus, and they've taken over and they've rebuilt the lodge, and they've got plans within plans of, you know, sort of world domination. And anyway, the son of the family, Caleb Braithwaite, basically is the one who figures out that Atticus is alive and that he's the last blood descendant of Titus Braithwaite. And so they've got this idea that they can use him in their scheming, and he gets drawn into them because he gets drawn into their scheming. And then the Winthrops are a separate family based in Chicago. And Hiram Winthrop was somebody who was in a feud with Caleb Braithwaite's father, Samuel Braithwaite. And basically Samuel killed him back in the 1930s. And so the Winthrop house where Letitia eventually ends up living is the house where Hiram Winthrop lived, and his ghost is still there.
Okay.
So there's this distant family connection between the two of them. And this has been changed around a bit in the TV show, but that was the basic idea, is that you've got this original son, this ancient order, this order of the ancient dawn, and then this disaster happens, and then the survivors basically scatter and set up little chapters all over the country that are competing with each other. And so the master plan of the Caleb Braithwaite is to unite them all again. He wants to basically be like the Al Capone or the Frank Costello of sorcery. So,
okay. I guess I didn't pick that up. I thought they were battling for world's domination.
They may be on the TV show, because I don't know exactly where Misha is going with it, but that's the basic notion, is that yes, you've got these competing groups of white magicians who, and you know, they're happy to use black folks as pawns, but they just
and are you okay with Caleb being Christina on the show?
Absolutely. Again, I it's an interesting change. I think one of the decisions in the novel I made was I wanted all of the viewpoint characters to be black, because I felt that if I'm writing about the horrors of racism, it just intuitively made sense to keep the focus on those characters for whom it is a horror. And I didn't want to get sidetracked into the thing where, oh, we need to have a white character for the reader to identify with, because I felt like if you need that, then this book isn't going to be for you anyway. So, but if I had made Caleb Braithwaite into a woman, I think it would have been too tempting to get inside her head and want to see how she saw the world. Whereas, Caleb Braithwaite in the novel, you kind of don't need. He's transparent enough that you can understand him without seeing his point of view. What makes him interesting, he's an example of what I call the glamour of evil, where unlike the other villains in the story who tend to be very mean and crude, and you know, he's always very polite and he's ruthless, but when he exploits you, he's very apologetic about it and tries to make up for it. And you know, he's like the annoying relative who won't leave your house. And you know, you can insult him to his face and he'll just kind of nod and then just keep talking and saying, you know, I know you're upset, but here's why I need you to do this. And I'll give you, you know, I'll do something nice for you in exchange. And so And what's been interesting to me is, yeah, a lot of there are even some readers who have a hard time just because he's so nice. Mm-hmm. They confuse that with goodness. Whereas to me, it's like there's no connection between charisma and morality necessarily. And
right.
But it's amazing how easy it is to, especially when you've got nastier villains standing right next to him, to say, well, how bad is he really? And I'm like, are you not paying attention to what he's actually doing? But yeah.
Yeah. So you said your book is finished. Your story is told. It's in HBO's hands now. And you're good with that. I think readers will often wonder, you know, what kind, if any, problems you would have with the sort of retelling of what is essentially your baby, right? So are there any departures that, and I'll spoil one thing. So
sure.
In the book, Uncle George makes it home from Artem. Mm-hmm. In the show, he does not. And it's a big dramatic moment. But I got to say, when I was reading the book, Uncle George was really turning into one of my favorite characters. So I had hoped to see more of him in the show.
I mean, the thing is, I don't know yet where they're going to go with the series. And this is because there's magic. Yeah, he's dead. And it may be that's really the end, but you don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. I have not seen most of the season yet. I've seen the first few episodes. I got the same preview that the reviewers did. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I was sad that he died, but at the same time, I'm not inclined to second guess the story, mm-hmm. telling decisions until I've seen the whole thing, because you never know.
Right.
Again, in a world where magic exists, it's hard to say. So. Right. Yes, it was a very sad moment when he died, but I want to wait to see what all happens before I make any final judgments on that. And so far, I'm quite happy with everything they've done. So
okay.
The other thing too is, like, as a lot of people pointed out, that the acting between Journey Smollett, Bell, and Jonathan Majors, just the way she wordlessly communicates to him, yeah, George just died, and then his reaction is just a fantastic thing to witness, that what they're able to convey. And I just, having been on set and seeing how many takes some of these things take, I really hope they didn't have to play that more than one or two times, because that must have been so hard emotionally to do that, and then to do it more than once or twice is just must be. Because I was there when they filmed the block party scene, and that musical number that Journey and Winmi play, they did that like a dozen times just to get as many camera angles as possible. And every time they had to do the dialogue with the same enthusiasm, the same moves and everything. And that's where you really show your acting potential, not just to be able to do it once, but to be able to do it repeatedly with the same energy. And when it's cool when it's fun, but when I see those scenes where people are having these emotional breakdowns, I'm just like, that would kill you to do that more than two or three times in a day, I would think. Yeah.
So for me, the true star, the character that I'm more drawn to is Journey Smollett's Letty. The performance, I should say, I'm drawn to is Journey Smollett's. I find the character just a tad bit spicier than Letty in the book. Mm-hmm. Are you satisfied with the character development? Are they that we see on the television versus those that you created in the book? Are they?
I mean, Journey Smollett is an amazing actress. I mean, and the performance is great. Yeah, it's a little different than mine, my Letitia, but I'm okay with that. It's a different interpretation, and I like what they're doing with her. That's another change, is that in the book it's Montrose and George who are half brothers, and in the TV series it's Journey and Winmi who are half sisters. And all of the performances I have seen so far are amazing. I'm really enjoying them. And yeah, of course they're going to do things a little bit different, but that's fine.
Yeah, last night's episode was pretty wild. I had my jaw on the floor. Very powerful, very gory. I mean, it's just everything you look for in a show like that.
I think Misha was making some comments online about that she's a fan of gory decapitations, and so yeah. I was laughing at that. That guy getting his head chopped off by the elevator, whereas I tend to go for the somewhat more subtle. Like in the novel, the guy doesn't actually get decapitated, in part because if anybody actually gets killed, I'm going to have to figure out where the bodies went, because I'm sure somebody's going to want to know. And they came up with a solution for that. But So
is this series a one and done, or do you think there are more potential seasons for this storyline?
Oh, I certainly think they could go on. I mean, I was not directly involved in the script writing or the production, so I don't know how the season is going to end. Mm-hmm. And even to guess would be wrong, because I would just get some I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but certainly the idea was always that you could take this and do a lot more with it, because there's so many other stories you can tell. And obviously it's 1955 in the TV show, so you've got at least another 8 years, or so before the Civil Rights Act. So which would be sort of, if you were going to do an extended series, that would be a natural end point, probably that moment of, because that's the point when Green Book stopped publication shortly thereafter. That was the moment they were waiting for.
Okay.
So to the extent that for me was sort of the central motivating point, if I were going to carry the story forward, that would be the natural endpoint. It's like, yeah, okay, let's tell the story until the guide is no longer needed. And of course, even then there's many challenges ahead, but that's a good stretch of time to cover.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything about the way that HBO is producing the show that you look at and say, I should have done that? Something that they're doing differently than the way you wrote it, that you say, boy, that's an interesting take. I like that better than what I've done.
Not yet. Okay. And I think I would be surprised if I reacted that way, because again, I was really happy with my version of the story. I never saw it as the only way to tell it or the most comprehensive, but I'm content with the choices I made. I might see something and say, oh, that's really clever. But most of my reaction right now has just been sort of appreciating the challenge of, taking a prose medium and turning it into a visual medium and conveying the same things with a different dialect of storytelling. Just, little things like the opening. I have Atticus alone in a car driving back from Florida, but she puts him on a bus because unless you're going to do voiceover, you need to have somebody he can talk to convey information. And just the way that often with just a single image, you can convey stuff that I might take a paragraph or two to describe in the book. So,
right.
But again, it's not like they did it better. It's just, they're speaking a somewhat different language and they're doing it well. And I could not have done it that way. So,
So what's next for you? What are you working on now?
Well, actually I just, behind me, you can see on the other side, I just published a book called 88 Names.
And
that is, that is a science fiction story set about 20 years in the future. It's about a guy his name's John Chu, and he is a paid guide to online video games. Basically, if you want to play World of Warcraft or, the futuristic equivalent, but you don't have time to build up a character, you can pay this guy and he'll provide you with a ready-made character and a team of expert players to join you and cater a nice adventure for you. So he gets a new client who's offering an insane amount of money for a comprehensive guide to the world of virtual reality gaming. And he comes to suspect that this client is actually the North Korean dictator, Kim Jong-un, who's interested in this for, more nefarious reasons than simple entertainment. And the thing is, the story is set almost entirely in virtual reality, where everyone has control over how they look and sound. So, and the people my protagonist is interacting with, not just this Kim Jong-un character, but even his coworkers and even his ex-girlfriend are people he's never met in real life. So it's sort of the ultimate masquerade cyber thriller cat and mouse game. So that was what I just published. And then, I'm still sort of thinking about what I'm going to do next. And right now I'm just so focused on the TV show. So.
Yeah. Well, I can't wait to dive into that one. I look forward to seeing how the story plays out on HBO. I'm really enjoying it, and I really appreciate you being a part of our show today. This was a thrill for me.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for joining us for another Pop Life. The show is a product of WAER Syracuse Public Media. Please consider supporting the podcast and our other content by becoming a sustaining member of WAER. You can donate at WAER.org and be sure to rate the show wherever you get your podcast to help us reach a wider audience. I'm Joe Lee.